Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Today's first hour comes from the Focus Archives, so as you listen, keep in mind that we will not be taking calls. This morning, in this hour of Focus, we'll talk about the life and work of Albert Einstein. And our guest for the program is Walter Isaacson. He's the author of a recently published biography of Einstein. The book first came out in hardcover last year and just recently has been published in paperback. The title is Einstein, His Life and Universe. The book is published by Simon & Schuster and has got a lot of positive attention. You might seek it out in the bookstore or the library. And certainly in this hour, we'll talk and take questions from the guests. Walter Isaacson. He's president and CEO of the Aspen Institute. He has been the chairman and CEO of CNN and also the managing editor of Time magazine and has a lot of experience as a journalist. He is the author of a previous book, Benjamin Franklin and American Life. It was published in 2003, and we talked about it here on this program. And if you'd like to hear that interview, you can go to our web archive and listen to it there. And here this morning, we're welcoming your questions and comments. All we ask of callers is that people try to keep their comments brief. The number, if you're in Champaign Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana. Also across the country, if you happen to be listening on the internet, and that is 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Isaacson, hello.
Hey, it's great to be with you again, David.
Well, we appreciate it very much, giving us your time. I think that it's fair to say that more than any other individual, Albert Einstein has come to represent genius in the popular imagination. I don't think there's anybody who can touch him for that. The question I wanted to start out with is, and this was true, it's true now, and I think it was true when Einstein was still alive. Was Einstein conscious, was Einstein the man conscious of being Einstein the iconic figure?
Yes, it happened in May 1919. He was a pretty obscure theoretical physicist, and nobody knew whether he was right or wrong in this crazed theory of relativity he had come up with. But they were able to test it by a total eclipse of the sun came along in May 1919. And Einstein had predicted that when light passes right next to the sun, the gravitational field of the sun will bend that light by 1.7 arc seconds. It was a very specific prediction of his theory of relativity. And so Sir Arthur Eddington, a British Quaker pacifist, sent out a delegation to measure the bending of starlight by the sun, and Einstein turned out to be right. And suddenly, he's on the front page of every newspaper. The New York Times, back in the days when the Times knew how to write great headlines, writes a headline saying, "Lights all askew in the heavens, stars not where they calculated to be, eclipse observation reveals that Einstein theory triumphs." And he became a huge icon in this world, and he loved it. You know, even though he complained about publicity, he was one of those people who actually liked it as well.
Yeah, and that points out that at least at the beginning, that it took some time for physics to embrace his ideas, at least the things that he's primarily known for, the ideas that he lays out in these four papers that he wrote in 1905, it took some years before they came generally to be accepted. And even then, I'm not sure after that point, did the physics community really embrace him?
That's a good question, David. In 1905, he's a patent examiner in the Swiss Patent Office because he can't get a job teaching at a university because nobody thinks he's that good. And even after he writes these 1905 papers, one of them is relativity theory, the other is quantum theory, he still can't get a job. In 1906, after his miracle year, he applies to jobs at 17 universities around Europe, gets turned down by every one of them. It's not until 1909 that he's actually made a professor at a university, and there he's only a junior professor. So it takes a while because his theories were so radical for the rest of the physics establishment to embrace him.
Yeah, and I think that makes a point that perhaps the fact that after he came out of the Zurich Polytechnic, the fact that he couldn't get a university post and that he went into this job in the patent office that really wasn't particularly challenging, what it did do, first of all, was give him time so that he could do his own work. And the other thing that may here be important is that he wasn't really part of the physics community. He stood outside of it, and I wonder whether, in fact, that might have made it easier or positioned him better to challenge what was the prevailing line of thought on things.
I think that's exactly right, David. I mean, here you have a guy who we sometimes feel sorry for because he's working 6 days a week in the patent office on a stool looking at patent applications. But as you said, he would not have been a very good acolyte in the academy trying to teach the conventional wisdom of some senior professor. He was much better off challenging authority and questioning things. And that's what his boss at the patent office told him to do. Every time a patent application comes in, challenge every assumption, question every theory that the and premise that the person has, and then try to visualize how it works. And there he was examining patent devices for people who wanted to synchronize clocks because Switzerland had just gone on standard time zones, and the Swiss, you know, being rather Swiss, wanted to make sure that it would strike 7 in Bern at the exact same moment it strikes 7 in Zurich. And so they had all these devices that would send signals between two distant clocks to synchronize them. And this is the germ of the theory of relativity, because he's trying to visualize how would a light signal look to different people in different states of motion.
I think it's become something of a commonplace when people talk about Einstein to say, well, you know, if you had met Einstein when he was a boy or when he was a teenager, you would have had no hint of what he would become. And I'm not sure that that's really true. At least there are two things that I think are interesting and I'd like you to talk about. One is that when he was young, he definitely demonstrated an aptitude for mathematics. And the other was this this tendency that he had to maybe have a difficult time with language, but to have a real ability to think in images, and that was something that he certainly applied to the work that he was later going to do and became so famous for.
Well, you're right. He does have a difficult time with language. I mean, those of us who are parents can take heart that Einstein was no Einstein when he was a kid, because he's so slow in learning how to talk that they called him the dopey one in the family, and they consulted a doctor. But that ties in, I think, to what you said about him thinking in images, because he's always visualizing things rather than thinking in words. Even when his dad gives him a compass when Einstein's like 5 years old, Einstein is trying to visualize how that field works, why it keeps making the compass needle point north. And that's also why he was good in math. He realized that a mathematical equation is just a brushstroke that nature uses to paint the mysteries of nature. And so he would visualize what a mathematical equation actually looked like. For him, if you know, if you, David, saw a phrase like rosy-fingered dawn when you're reading Homer, you picture a rosy-fingered dawn. For Einstein, he's looking at math equations, and he can picture them. So if you Google Einstein failed math, you get tens of thousands of websites where people say, well, as everybody knows, Einstein failed math as a kid, and maybe there's hope for me. But that's not really true. He did very well in math. It was languages he did poorly at.
Yeah. That's really this idea of thinking in images and doing the thought experiments. It's an interesting one to me, and in fact, I suppose if you look at it this way, you'd say, well, Einstein, in doing the work that he did and thinking about the things that he didn't have the kind of research tools that physicists today have. There was no other way for him to do what he did other than to do it in his head.
Well, there are a lot of good experimentalists. People like Michelson and Morley were proving through experiment that the speed of light seemed constant, whether you were moving to the source of the light or away from the light. So you did have people like that, and of course Lorentz and Poincaré are able to be, you know, take experimental data and try to come up with theories. What Einstein did, though, is his was purely imaginative. He did it totally through thought experiments, visualizing things, what you and I might call daydreaming, but he gets to call them thought experiments because he's Einstein. And you're right. It's not like the other scientists of the time who mainly were looking at experimental data and trying to analyze it.
And certainly, yeah, as you say, we don't want to underestimate the contributions of other scientists or the fact that there were a lot of other brilliant men. I suppose mostly they were men. at the time doing this kind of work, but you then still, you come back to this question, well, why him? Why Einstein? Why this man, young, relatively young man, why this man was the guy who came up with the idea, who sort of put it all together, and not somebody else?
Right, and that's pretty much the theme of the book, is sort of why him? What made him special? Because other people were just as smart, let's say Max Planck or Lorentz, but it's Einstein who can take the creative leap, the imaginative leap. And to me, that's what accounts for genius. Just to give you one specific example, Max Planck was probably, up until Einstein came along, the greatest theoretical physicist in Europe. And he had come up with an equation that explained how radiation worked when you heated up a piece of metal. And the equation had a little tiny constant in it, it's called Planck's constant, that you needed to throw in order to make the equation come out right. Max Planck didn't know what it was, he just called it a mathematical contrivance. But Einstein, sitting on his stool in the patent office, is able to look at that equation and say, that means light is a particle. Not just a wave, it's a particle and a wave. And that is a leap of the imagination that Max Planck, even 10 years later, when he's trying to recruit Einstein to come to the University of Berlin, is saying, well, I'm still not sure about that leap that Einstein made on quantum theory. But of course, quantum theory turns out to be right.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Walter Isaacson. He is the author of a recently published biography of Albert Einstein. The title of the book is Einstein, His Life and Universe. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Just recently has come out in paperback, and our guest is spending some time traveling around talking about the book. He is the president and CEO of the Aspen Institute and has been the chairman and CEO of CNN and the managing editor of Time Magazine. He's also the author of a biography of Ben Franklin that came out a few years ago. You can find that, I'm sure, still in the bookstore. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the interview, we talked about, that is, Walter Isaacson and I talked about the Ben Franklin book. And if you'd like to hear that interview, you can go to our web archive and see it there. The number here, if you want to call in, you have questions, comments, 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. You've been a journalist for a long time and have a lot of experience as a reporter. Had you spent much time in the classroom studying physics?
Well, I like science, and my dad was an engineer. But people in my generation, if you're not a physicist, you get intimidated by science. And when I was writing about Benjamin Franklin, I was struck by the fact that those electricity experiments, we think of him as a doddering old dude flying a kite in the rain, but those electricity experiments that he did with the kite were really important, and Thomas Jefferson loved science, and that it was a shame that people in my generation who are not scientists sometimes feel intimidated by science. So I wanted to do something where I could throw myself back into learning the beauty of science. It's complicated, but so is I just saw Antony and Cleopatra, the Shakespeare play they did down in Washington a couple days ago. That's complicated to know exactly what Octavius is doing, but we can appreciate that. And I think we should also try to appreciate science. So I got a chance to spend 4 or 5 years studying the math and the science and having some good tutors walk me through it. But I hope the book is not really a science book. You don't really need to know the science in order to read the book. You'll appreciate the science, the fact that it's creative and imaginative, just like Stravinsky or Picasso is creative and imaginative. Yeah.
Well, certainly, I think what is true is that the book looks both at the science and the man, and I'm sure books have been written. One could write a book just about the science and say, well, that's the only thing
that... books or so yeah. written about the science of Einstein, and they're wonderful books.
Yeah, but I think your argument is that it helps... Well, it may not help you understand the science, but to understand the man tells you something about where the science came from or where the ideas came from, or maybe gets back to this idea we were talking a little bit about before, trying to get at the answer to that question, why him?
Exactly. Understanding his rebellious nature, his ability to think visually, his willingness to defy convention, all of that's part of his personality. It's part of his politics. I mean, he's a pacifist in 1914 in Germany when everybody else is marching off to World War I. But you also see that in his science. And that answers the key question, which is what makes a person who is smart into somebody who's creative and imaginative? What sets him apart from Max Planck or Lorentz or Poincaré or all the other scientists of that period? And that, you need to understand the man and the personality.
Yeah, it certainly, it helps, I think it points to the fact that we may not understand real well what genius is, but one can say that genius is more than sheer intelligence.
And you probably know better than I do from this radio show, that smart people are a dime a dozen. There are a lot of really intelligent people, and a lot of them don't amount to much. It takes something special to move from being smart to being creative and imaginative, and that's the theme of the book.
We have a caller here. Would welcome others here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. This caller's in Charleston, Illinois, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I would like to ask a question, then I'll hang up in regards to Einstein the man. A recent article I saw on the web said that there's some new letters that Einstein wrote that at least were characterized in this article as being extremely negative in regards to religion, peoples of faith, the existence of God. I read other articles that said that Einstein had a more benign, or I guess you would say, if not positive, accepting attitude in regards to these issues. And I would just be curious on your expert to see how he would characterize Einstein on these issues. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you very much.
All right. Very good.
Well, thank you for the question. Einstein had a complicated view, like many of us do, about God. But it was a generally positive view about faith and about religion. And I know the new letter that came out where he says he doesn't believe in a personal God that you can pray to and God will intervene on your behalf. He calls that a silly superstition. But he also says that I'm not an atheist, and I dislike it when the atheists try to claim me. When asked directly, do you or do you not believe in God, he would say, I believe that there's a spirit manifests in the laws of the universe, a spirit in the face of which we must be humbled and awed. And to me, that is my sense of a cosmic religion and my faith. He said, we know that the universe was created, and we look at it as a child would look at a set of books in a library, and we try to understand the order. And it's a topic far too vast for our limited imaginations, so we should be reverential about it instead of trying to proselytize. He always fought against pure atheism, but he also fought against those who would believe a personal God would create miracles on your behalf. At one point he said, for some people, the existence of miracles is evidence of God's existence. But for me, it's the absence of miracles, the harmonies manifest in the laws of the universe that are evidence of God's existence. He wrote many essays about science and faith. At one point he said that religion without science is blind, and science without religion is lame, that we need them both. So despite that letter coming out where he sort of dismisses the notion of a personal God who will, you know, help make the Cubs win the World Series if you pray hard enough, he does believe in what he calls God, and frankly the same thing Benjamin Franklin would have said, a deist concept of God who's manifest in the universe, but is a little bit too vast for our limited imaginations to comprehend.
Well, again, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. He was married twice, and these women were very important figures in his life. I'm tempted to say maybe the first was more important, but they were important in different ways.
Very different.
And his first wife was an academic woman, and at a time when there wouldn't have maybe be that many women in academia, at least not in the hard sciences and in mathematics, there would not have been. Tell us about Mileva Maric.
Very interesting woman, Mileva Maric. And as you said, back then it was hard for a woman to be taken seriously in physics and math. She was born in Serbia, and her father was a Serbian army officer. And so when she wanted to study math and physics, her father forced the all-male Zagreb Academy to take Mileva as a student. And she graduates first in her class, and she becomes the only woman in Einstein's class at the Zurich Polytechnic. And not surprisingly, they fall in love. She helps check the 1905 papers with him. She wants very much to be a physicist and a mathematician like he is. She does have trouble with her studies. First of all, she and Einstein fall so much in love, their parents are against marriage. They end up having an illegitimate child, a daughter, who they eventually put up for adoption. So it's a very tumultuous period for her when she's in college. So she doesn't pass her graduation exams and doesn't get her degree, which is a source of great turmoil and tension between them eventually. They do end up getting married and having two children. But the marriage falls apart for a variety of reasons. I mean, they're a very intellectually intense relationship. And at one point, he wants a divorce, but he hasn't been able to get a good job, so he can't afford a divorce. He says to her, one of these days, one of those papers will win the Nobel Prize. If you give me a divorce, I will give you the money. That's a pretty astonishing offer. And she takes a week. She's a good scientist. She consults with other scientists and finally accepts the bet. And it's not until 1922 that they announce his Nobel Prize, but she gets all the money and buys three apartment buildings in Zurich.
So she got the money. She obviously must have had faith in him and his ideas right at that beginning to say, all right, no matter how long it takes. Maybe she didn't think it was going to take that long.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting. It's almost like the question about God. People think that there's a simple relationship. Either you do or don't believe in God, or that two people like Mileva Marić and Einstein either loved each other or hated each other. But these are normal human relationships. She admired him, she adored him, and she hated him all at the same time, during the period of, 1910 to 1920, when they were fighting over custody of the children. And so it was a tumultuous relationship, and it was kept under seal until about 2 years ago. The letters between them were kept private, and they finally released them in 2006. And it's a large part on those 4,000 letters that I base part of this biography.
And they don't cast Einstein in a terribly flattering light, at least when it comes to his relations with her.
Right. His relations with her are very cold, and as I said, he wants a divorce. But, he's very generous, including with the Nobel Prize money and other financial support. He's cold towards his two boys after a while, but then misses them so desperately, he fights for custody over them and goes down finally and visits them. And, of course, when he immigrates to America in 1933, his son follows shortly thereafter, and they reconcile. So one of the things you learn about Einstein is he's actually a human being. We all know people who have tumultuous relationships with their kids and their family and then reconcile after they've thrown themselves for a decade or two into their work and they become workaholics and then they reconcile with their family. He reconciles with his first wife and even stays in one of those apartment buildings in Zurich whenever he visits Zurich. So he's a passionate individual, and that's what those letters show.
Hmm. One quick question here, and I want to promise I have a caller here I'll get to in just a second. Do you think that Mileva Marić has gotten the credit that she deserves for the contribution, whatever contribution she made to his developing the ideas that went into those four 1905 papers?
Yeah, it's a great and interesting historic controversy, especially on special relativity, whether she deserves more or less credit. And there are certainly letters that talk about our theory and when we published this theory. I do think that the full-fledged theory was Einstein's and only Einstein's. He had as a sounding board another engineer, the notion that time is relative depending on your state of motion. Now that we read all of the letters, we can see where the ideas come from, how he explains them to her, and she helps check the math. She helps prepare the papers, and she does something that's far more difficult, which is she puts up with him during that miracle year of 1905 and supports him. And I think that we do not need to exaggerate her contributions in order to do her justice and do her honor as somebody who truly struggled and was a real pioneer for women in the field of math and science, who overcame most but not all of the obstacles that was facing a woman who wanted to go into that field. So I try to get it exactly right as calibrated by the letters they wrote each other, but really give her an enormous amount of respect for what she did to help him.
Walter Isaacson is our guest this morning. He's the president and CEO of the Aspen Institute. He's been the chairman and CEO of CNN and managing editor of Time magazine. He's the author of Einstein, His Life and Universe. It's published by Simon & Schuster. First came out about a year ago in hardcover and just recently in paper. You can look for it in the library or the bookstore. You also might want to look at his previous book, A Biography of Ben Franklin. That book, Benjamin Franklin and American Life, was published in 2003. We have a caller here. Others would be welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. The caller here is in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Oh, yeah, hi. The Maliva Merrick situation is real sensitive. There's a couple of books written about her. And, you know, the recent letters you're mentioning, I guess you got to read all of them.
The letters that came out. The people at Caltech, there's a wonderful team there on the Einstein Papers Project led by Diana Cuomo's Buchwald. And I worked with her for 2 years before the letters were being released to just try to make sure that we understood them all.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, the daughter, is there a certainty about her being adopted?
No, there's no certainty. There's a wonderful set of books written about the search for Lee Zirl, the hidden daughter of Albert Einstein.
Nobody ever found her, right?
Nobody ever found her.
Well, I write fiction, and I wrote a short story about, fabricated this whole thing about where she reappeared in Italy.
I'd love to read that.
If you want, I'd take your email address and I'll email it to you. It's about 10,000 words. Mm-hmm. But the thing about this is that when you were talking about Einstein and his just profound genius, it sort of reminds me of when your kinds of books. Newton described gravity is the better thing. And then you have Darwin, and then Steven Weinberg was on this program a while back, and I had a chance to talk to him. But I was going to ask you a question, and it's kind of an odd question. When do you think Einstein realized his genius? I mean, sort of like having this knowledge that is so completely different than what was formally accepted.
Well, you talk about how he makes a leap of the imagination in a couple of instances.
I mean, when he recognized that I'm trying to say is that I don't know.
I understand your question. It's a good question.
Yeah, I don't know if he can. I'm wondering if when Darwin, I read a lot about Darwin. I read his journals and all this stuff, and you know, he saw Wallace seeing what he saw, but when Darwin all of a sudden that eureka moment, you might want to say, but when all of a sudden they go, wait a minute. Everything's different now, and I'm wondering if Einstein...
Here's where I think Einstein has that eureka moment.
Yeah.
He's done special relativity, which says that time is relative depending on your state of motion. And he wants to have a general theory of relativity that applies to accelerated motion, not just constant velocity motion. He also realizes that Newton's wrong about gravity. Newton has said that gravity is simply the attraction of two objects at a distance over empty space, instantly, magically at a distance. And Einstein says that makes no sense. And so he's sitting at his desk, and he imagines somebody falling, a painter falling from a rooftop across from his office. He says, imagine the painter falling to the ground. He'd feel weightless during that fall. And then Einstein turns it on its head and says, what do you feel when you're standing in a gravitational field? Suppose you're in an enclosed chamber. And he said, well, you'd feel your feet being pressed to the floor. You'd take something out of your pocket and you'd drop it and fall to the floor at an accelerated rate. He said, now imagine that enclosed chamber in outer space where there's no gravity, but it's accelerating upward. What would you feel? He said, well, your feet would be pressed to the floor. You'd take something out of your pocket and it would seem to fall to the floor at an accelerated rate. And he said, those are equivalent. The feeling, all of the local effects of gravity are equivalent to the effects of acceleration. And he calls that the happiest thought in his life. And from that, he realizes that gravity and acceleration are related. And he comes up with a theory of gravity, which is simply that gravity is when an object curves space. And then other objects sort of roll towards it because of the curving of space. Now, that's not an intuitive idea, but it's a huge leap of the imagination, and Einstein says that when he comes up with that notion, it's the happiest moment in his life. He has heart palpitations, and he realizes that he has come up with a whole new concept of the universe that totally throws out Newton's theory, and to him, that's when he realizes he's on to something big.
Yeah, and I agree with you on that, and I think what is interesting about Einstein is that he opened all of modern physics now is based on those insights. And, you know, the whole thing at CERN, the Large Hadron Collider that they built are going to turn it on, and they're looking for all these. I mean, it's just, it's very interesting to talk to, it'd be interesting to talk to him. I was alive when he was in his latter part of, I was born in 1950. But also, I was going to ask you a weird question. I know this is way off the thing, but I know they removed his brain when he died. Mm-hmm. Is it still around somewhere?
The last chapter of my book is called Einstein's Brain and Einstein's Mind. And what happens is he dies in 1955 at Princeton Hospital, and there's a guy named Dr. Thomas Harvey, who's the night autopsy person there, and he does the autopsy, and he takes out the brain, and he puts it in a Tupperware container, and he keeps it. Now, the next day at Princeton School, you know, one of the teachers says, does anybody know the news today? And a girl raises her hand and says, yes, Einstein died. And then a boy who doesn't usually speak in the class sits in the back, and he raises his hand and says, yes, and my dad has his brain. And this was like a huge piece of news. It becomes news in the New York Times and everything. And the family didn't quite know whether the hospital had a right to keep the brain. But this guy ended up keeping the brain, and for 20, 25 years, rides around America bringing it to different scholars to study the brain. But eventually, when Thomas Harvey, the pathologist, was in his 80s, he drove back to Princeton Hospital from where he lived in the Midwest and turned the brain back to Princeton Hospital. And so now I think it's safe storage at Princeton Hospital.
Yeah. I appreciate the comments of the caller. I need to kind of jump in here because we're coming into our last 20 minutes or so, and I have a couple of other people. And maybe we should just mention that this sounds kind of ghoulish, but at the time, there were people who somehow believed, or at least had this notion, that maybe if you could study the brains, that is the physical brains, the tissue of brilliant people, you could see something there that separated them from people who weren't so brilliant. And the idea was, could possibly brilliance be embodied in the organ itself? An idea I think now we'd say, well, actually, no. It's not that, you know,
right,
it's
David.
Just not in the, it's not in that, that
I think it
that,
was in his
tissue.
Mind and
yes.
Not his brain,
yes.
Is the way I put it. The mind was what was special, not the tissues of the brain.
Right. Well, let's talk with someone else, someone in Rankin on a cell phone. This is line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Another wonderful show. Fascinating story about the brain. I never heard that before. Just a couple of quick questions for your guests, and I'll take my answers off the air. I was wondering if you could fast-forward to Eisenhower, World War II, and what, if any, relationship he had with Oppenheimer. And there was a story that he put his name to a letter to FDR urging him not to use the bomb. I was wondering if there was any truth to that. And then him leaving Germany and I think taking his position with Princeton, am I right to assume he got out of Germany just in the nick of time with regards to World War II and the Nazis? And finally, is there anything unique or special about his time in Princeton that the guests would care to relate? And I'll go ahead and listen off air. Thanks.
All right. Well, I'll start with him leaving in 1933 and coming to Princeton. And he understood, he had been a pacifist, but as soon as Hitler takes power, he says, I'm no longer a pacifist. I think we have to stand up and fight Hitler. Fortunately for Einstein, he was not in Germany when Hitler took power. He was traveling from Caltech and traveled back to Belgium. But by the end of that year, he settles in Princeton, New Jersey, at the Institute for Advanced Study. What he does in 1939 is the first great letter he does. He does it with Leo Szilard and Teller and Wigner, but Einstein signs a letter to Franklin Roosevelt based on Szilard's concept of a controlled nuclear chain reaction and says to the president, this could lead to the construction of bombs. So that's the thing that really kicks off the Manhattan Project and the bomb-making project. Now, somewhat ironically, because Einstein had been such a pacifist, J. Edgar Hoover of the FBI would not give him a security clearance, so he didn't work on the Manhattan Project. But we still associate him with the dropping of the bomb. When the bomb is dropped, Time magazine has Einstein on the cover with the mushroom cloud behind him and E equals MC squared on the mushroom cloud. So Einstein becomes somewhat chagrined that the bomb has been used and we don't have a way to control it. So he and Oppenheimer and others had been pressing. They didn't press that the bomb shouldn't be used, But they pressed near the end of the war to be careful about how the bomb was used and to have a system of arms control to try to control the bomb. And so when the war ends in 1945, for the last decade of his life after that, Einstein is dedicating himself to the cause of world peace and the cause of arms control. And that's what he does in Princeton for the last 10 years. He's really involved in a few things. One is searching for a unified field theory that will overcome the uncertainties in quantum mechanics and tie together all the forces of nature. Secondly, he's involved as a scientist as leading the cause for an arms control because he believed that you shouldn't allow nations to have individual nuclear weapons or you'd have another war. At one point, somebody asked him, how do you think World War III will be fought? And he says, I don't know, but I know how World War IV could be fought with sticks and rocks. So that was what he did a lot when he was in Princeton those last 10 years.
All right, we'll continue. Next, we'll talk with someone in Champaign, and this is line number two. Hello.
Yes, two related questions. In 1905, Einstein was this obscure Swiss patent examiner, and the content of his papers was revolutionary. And yet, I guess he was able to submit them and get them published without too much trouble. And so, first question is, how was it that that was true, since so often revolutionary stuff has a lot of trouble getting accepted, even to the point of being published? And the second thing is, and this is sort of a speculative question and perhaps a little unfair, but if Einstein had not existed and had not published those papers, how much was any of this in the zeitgeist? How long would it have been before somebody else would have come up with these same ideas?
Two very good questions. It is surprising to me that at the time, a third-class patent examiner who's overthrowing Newton's ideas of space and time can get it published in a very good journal, the Annals of Physics, Annalen der Physik, a German journal. And nowadays, unless you're well-known and fit with the establishment, it may be hard to get published in a refereed journal. This was a refereed journal. Fortunately, one of the referees of the journal was Max Planck, who I said earlier in the show was probably up until that moment the greatest theoretical physicist alive. And Max Planck understands that even though this relativity theory seems odd, there's something to it. And so he approves the publication of it in the Journal of Physics. And Einstein had also already published some book reviews and smaller pieces in the journal, so it was easier for him to get published. But, you know, we should worry today, maybe the Internet will help us get around that problem because anybody can publish on the Internet, but we should worry today that if you're not part of the academy and the physics establishment, it may be hard for you to pull off an Einstein. Now, on whether or not other people would have discovered what he did, I do think special relativity, the notion that time is relative depending on your state of motion, people were close to that one. And had Einstein not come along in 1905, it's possible that, you know, in the next 5 or 10 years, we would have come somewhere close to that theory, although it does involve a true revolutionary leap, which is that time actually is different and nobody's right or wrong about time. I think on general relativity, the notion that gravity is the curvature of space and time, that was such an unbelievable leap of the imagination that there are people in my book, great scientists in my book, who say it's not clear when, if ever, we would have made that brilliant leap.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. I guess it's still, I find myself wondering, this notion, to the extent that they understand it, basically says that that if you have two individuals moving at different speeds, that is, the one who is moving faster, to him time will seem to be moving more slowly than for the person who is moving at the slower speed. How would such a notion even have occurred to you,
well,
or to him?
First of all, if you don't mind, David, let me correct it slightly.
Please do, if that's wrong.
There is no way to say somebody's moving faster than somebody else. There's no sort of at rest at the universe where you can say, okay, you're sitting there, David, in your studio, so you're at rest, and I'm the one, if I'm running by outside your window, I'm the one in motion. You're moving right now, and so am I. We're all moving on a planet that's rushing around the sun. The sun's rushing around the galaxy. Everything
in the universe is in motion, and you can't say, all you can say is, what is your relative motion to mine? Mm-hmm. Not that I'm moving faster or you're moving slower or you're at rest. So that's part of the insight of relativity, which is nobody's right or wrong. They can't say, I'm the one who's actually standing still, so my perceptions are right. What Einstein does it partly just by imagining a fast-moving train. And he says to himself, suppose there's a fast-moving train and lightning strikes both ends of that fast-moving train. How would somebody decide whether those lightning strikes are simultaneous? Well, he says, imagine a guy on the platform, and he's halfway between the two lightning strikes. He sees the light from both of them at the exact same moment, so he says those strikes are simultaneous. But imagine there's a woman in the train, and in the nanosecond it takes for the light to travel, she's moved forward a tiny, tiny amount. So she says the lightning strike in front happened first, because she sees the light from that one first. All relativity says, as I mentioned earlier, is that neither one of them is right and neither one of them is wrong. The guy on the platform can't say, I'm right because I'm standing still, and you're wrong because you're on a moving train. Both perceptions are equally valid, and so what is simultaneous is relative depending on your state of motion. And he does that just by looking outside of his window, looking at the trains going past all the famous Bern clock tower into the station, and imagine how are you going to synchronize that clock, that's the famous Bern clock tower, that's the standard time zone for all of Switzerland, with distant clocks. And if you tried to define them striking simultaneous, wouldn't the person on the train have a different definition of what is simultaneous?
We have about maybe 8 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. I'd just like to introduce again our guest, Walter Isaacson. He's the author of a biography of Albert Einstein. The book is Einstein, His Life and Universe. It has just come out in paperback. It's published by Simon & Schuster. So if you'd like to read about Einstein and his ideas, you head out to the bookstore or the library and look for the book. Questions are welcome, too. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We've talked a little bit about the impact, particularly of the ideas in these four papers that were published in 1905. They were so revolutionary, in fact, that at the beginning, at least, the rest of the physics community, many of them didn't really quite know what to make of them. They weren't even in a position to say, whether they thought he was right or wrong. Eventually, it was demonstrated that he was, in fact, correct, and they came to be accepted. I realize, kind of a big question, but if you say, look at the understanding that we would have said we had of the universe before Einstein, how the post-Einstein universe is different.
I think that Einstein's universe is just unbelievably beautiful and elegant. All the forces tie together so that you can understand gravity as just a curving of space instead of mysterious things happening to different bodies. Also, we have a disjuncture in the universe that we still haven't solved, a problem, a dilemma, which is Einstein's theory of relativity does not actually mesh very nicely with Einstein's quantum theory. What happens at the subatomic level seems to happen by chance. Einstein didn't believe that. He kept saying, I cannot believe that God plays dice with the universe. But where the quantum realm, which is these realms of the photons and electrons and how they act, intersect with the realm of things we can see, which is governed by relativity, we still have a disjuncture. And that's why Einstein, on his deathbed, is still writing equations, trying to get a unified theory that will tie these two forces together. So he did not leave us a perfect universe. He left us a universe where, in our century, we're going to have to find that holy grail that he was seeking on his deathbed, which is something that reconciles quantum theory with relativity theory. Mm.
You make the argument, and I think that it's convincing, that what made Einstein Einstein was his rebellious, unconventional nature, his willingness to reject or at least question what was the accepted ways of seeing things. And it does seem to be true also that once Einstein got to the point in his life where he was a little bit more settled, he was maybe not quite as productive. That's not to say he stopped thinking of things, but
well, he was certainly not quite as rebellious.
Well, right? And I think he himself felt that he might have gotten to a point where he was a little bit more set, more rigid, more had more difficulty maybe challenging his own ideas.
Yeah, you know, and it's very interesting. I've turned 50 now. And I think as we all look at ourselves, and we had some rebellious, creative ideas when we were in our 20s and 30s, and then suddenly for Einstein, in 1925 or so, when his quantum theory leads to this notion that I mentioned a few moments ago, that at the subatomic level, things happen by chance, and there's certain randomness, and Heisenberg has his uncertainty principle. Einstein just rebels against that. He starts defending the classical order. And why is it all of us, perhaps, or most of us, when we get into our 40s and our 50s, we become a little bit more defensive about the classical order of things and a little bit less willing to overturn things? He was asked that. He said, but, you know, the younger colleagues who were believing in quantum mechanics would say to him, Einstein, you used to be somebody who always questioned authority. And he would say, yes, perhaps to punish me for my contempt for authority, the good Lord turned me into an authority myself. And so I find that an interesting theme in the second half of the book, that he's a little bit more conservative in what he feels is true about physics.
And I wonder if that maybe also has something to do with the fact that at a certain point, uncertainty just gets to be a little too much. And I don't know if that has to do with maturing and aging, or it has to do with the idea that you want it, you want to believe that there is in fact some order in the universe, and you can take this idea of chaos and uncertainty and unpredictability a little too far.
You know, I think you're exactly right. He loved the solid foundation of what we would call realism, that there are real laws out there. And even if we can't observe them, even if Heisenberg's right, you can never observe the exact position and momentum of a particle, Einstein would still believe, yes, but it still has a real position and a momentum at the same time. And I think he rebelled against the fact that his relativity principle and relativity theory was used by those who became moral relativists and said there's no certainty in the universe. And he actually liked to call his relativity theory invariance theory, because if you tie together space and time, things work by exact invariant laws. And so when you get quantum mechanics where things are uncertain, he just did not like to believe that there was an uncertainty at the core of the universe.
We talked a little bit earlier about his tempestuous relationship with his first wife, Mileva Marić, and also the fact that she was a very brilliant woman herself, and certainly helped him in his work. Just in our last little bit here, to give equal time, tell us about his second wife and what sort of support she provided, because she certainly did, although it was maybe a different kind.
Elsa was very different. Elsa was actually Einstein's first cousin. They had known each other since childhood. And Elsa was not a scientific genius. And she was once asked if she understood relativity theory, and she said, no, it has nothing to do with my things I need to know for my daily life. And so she never tried to understand it. On the other hand, she's a lot smarter, I think, reading the letters, than a lot of historians have made her out to be. She spoke many languages. She handled the logistics for her husband, who was, you know, rather spacey and up in 30,000 feet thinking grand thoughts. And Elsa kept the household, handled all the travel, was a great diplomat, had a wonderful sense of humor. And I think she and Einstein had a pretty solid relationship. She loved being Mrs. Einstein, married to him. He loved the way that she doted and took care of him. And, you know, we can all be judgmental about, well, how did he treat his first wife? Why was his second wife so doting and, you know, mothering to him? But the heart is a darker forest than even the subatomic levels of the universe, and a murkier place. And I just try to report what I think was a relationship that they both kind of liked.
Mm. You talked earlier about the fact that, you know, I asked the first question was about how Einstein felt, or did he recognize that he was this iconic figure? Sort of the question is, did Einstein understand he was Einstein? And you said, yes, in fact, he did, and he kind of enjoyed that. He also, though, was called upon to make pronouncements on all sorts of things that didn't have anything to do with science. How did he feel about that role?
Well, he did it with some good humor, and by the end of his life, he's happy to make all sorts of pronouncements. I mean, he talks about education, and he says, you know, the purpose of education is to instill imagination and creativity. Let's not educate by rote. He talks about the atom bomb. Yeah, he becomes very fervent in favor of arms control. About the state of Israel, he was initially against all forms of nationalism, but he becomes a deep supporter of the state of Israel. And so he kind of liked to give, three kids from the high school newspaper near Princeton knock on the door at 112 Mercer Street, he gives a nice long interview about math and everything else. So he's somebody who's an easygoing guy who expresses his opinions, but also knows where to stay out of certain things. He got involved in politics to protect people who were the target of the McCarthy Red Scare investigations, but on other aspects of politics, he'd keep his nose out of it.
Yeah. I mentioned the fact that you'd written this book about Franklin, and for a lot of us, Franklin certainly seems to be a person of a distant age, this man that we see in the portraits and in carved in marble. Now, Einstein, neither of us could have met him, but he was still more a person of our time than Franklin. Do you have a feeling now, having done this, that you got to know Einstein in a sense that you feel that you would say, I know this man as I have a feeling for this man as a flesh and blood human being?
Yes. I mean, he is so flesh and blood and so open about who he is. And we're so lucky that there's, I don't know, it seems like 4,000 file drawers full of letters and diaries and letters from him and to him and to his wife. It was the days before we used to text message and telephone people. And so you'd hear all about his day and his anxieties. And I kind of feel, I obviously don't understand the depths of his science. Very few people do in a truly sophisticated way. But I do feel I understand the guy. After all these years of reading his letters and knowing about him, he's the type of person that, even though you and I would be somewhat intimidated by his genius, if we were sitting there at the Nassau Inn in Princeton and he walked in and sat down, we'd be totally charmed by him and we'd say, okay, I get this guy. I know people like him.
Yeah. Our guest is Walter Isaacson. The book is Einstein, His Life and Universe, published by Simon & Schuster. Mr. Isaacson, thank you very much.
It's always great to be on your show, David.